What the Health with Gabby Allen on FUBAR Radio.
Good morning and welcome to What the Health with me, Georges Bertineau, back once again standing in for Gabby Allen, who is still currently away on Project Find Love in sunny South Africa. A little bit about myself. I'm an online coach helping everyday people make everyday better decisions. I've got a BSc in sports rehabilitation. I've worked in professional sport for 5 years, and I've been in the fitness and health I've been a fitness and health expert for over a decade. Here today we're going to be talking to you about the world of health and fitness and supporting you through your fitness journeys. Each week I'll be joined by a range of guests to dissect the latest fitness trends, separating facts from myths and advising you on achieving your health goals. Coming up today on the show, we're going to be joined by Adrienne Brownlee, a British mountaineer and adventure athlete, Sophie Bertrand, nutritionist, and now coming up first, we're going to be speaking with Malgo Kenyon, head of brand and marketing at Lumi. Malgo, good morning. How are you?
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much. Yourself?
Yes, very well, thank you.
Good, great to perfect.
Speak with you today.
Yeah, likewise. I'm actually really excited for this one because I actually own a Lumi Light. So
yes.
I'm a proud owner and I obviously understand a little bit about SAD. But let's start by explaining what SAD stands for and what it is.
Sure. SAD stands for seasonal affective disorder, which is a type of depression that comes on usually during autumn and winter and generally is seasonal. And it is a condition that, as perhaps you may have experienced yourself, basically is brought on by, among other things, the reduction in natural daylight. And it was first recognized in the 80s by this American psychiatrist who've experienced it himself, called Norman Rosenthal. And so if anyone's looking to kind of learn a little bit more about it, I can really recommend his books that go really in depth into the whole subject.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really fascinating subject and topic. You know, can you explain to us what an SAD lamp kind of is and how, you know, I know you've explained what SAD is, but explain about the light, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, Professor Rosenthal, whom I mentioned, was the first one to kind of really think about light therapy as a solution to those struggling with seasonal affective disorder or a milder sort of a condition called winter blues. So SAD lamps or bright light therapy lamps are essentially like having your own little slice of summer in a box, and they work by mimicking sort of the brightness and intensity of natural daylight to help regulate your body clock and therefore also boost your mood and keep your energy levels during the darker months sort of in a similar way as they would be during your summer months. And like for, I guess, the science bit about keep it light, our brains essentially rely on sunlight to regulate hormones such as the serotonin hormone, happiness hormone, mm-hmm. or melatonin, the sleep hormone. So when the daylight hours are limited, so like in autumn and winter, and melatonin can kind of be a little bit out of whack, we can be sort of a little bit more sleepy, sluggish, mm-hmm. and moody because it's a little bit too dominant. It's not getting suppressed enough. And
yeah.
What's suppresses it is bright light. And so SAD lamps deliver that kind of 10,000 lux of brightness. So on your, just for context, say I'm right now in like a windowless environment, and if I didn't have my SAD lamp on, which I do, and it's lighting up my face, the room would be around 500 lux, for instance.
Okay.
So that change, like, you know, that kind of gap between the light that SAD lamp delivers and what you have in your regular office is really huge. And on like a clear summer day, lux levels outside will be 100,000, right?
Yes, okay.
But on like a winter's day, really cloudy, gloomy day, maybe 2,000? So It's vast, that difference that's delivered by light therapy to kind of really bring us up into that sort of sunny mood.
Yes, I mean, really fascinating stuff. I have mine facing the wall, so the light kind of bounces off. Is that correct? Wow. Or are you meant to? Because I always found the light like quite, it's super, super bright. And obviously I understand the purpose behind it, but would you recommend, how would you recommend using it, you know, against the wall so it kind of lightens up the whole room? Or would you say you need to kind of have it facing yourself?
You do need to have it facing yourself to get the most benefit. So I do actually have a Luxmeter right here. So I'll turn off my lamp and, like, as you maybe can see, if you're
seeing
me on video, you'll be able to see that it's actually quite bright in here because I've got all these lamps on. Mm-hmm. So my lux levels in the room are 860, but close to my bright light therapy lamp, which I've just turned on, those levels are now 5,700.
Wow.
You know? So, I mean, the closer you get to it, the brighter it will be. Now, you don't have to stare at it, but the recommended sort of positioning would be to have it perhaps at arm's length, whatever's comfortable. You can always opt for a lamp that has adjustable brightness.
Okay.
So if you can't quite handle the really bright levels, you can go a little bit lower to start getting used to it. However, the sort of less bright it is, the longer you should be using it.
Okay.
But bottom line, arm's length, perhaps half an hour to an hour, are particularly beneficial in the first part of your day to kind of signal that, hello, it's morning, it's, you know, let's get going. And also just after lunch, if you're struggling with any of that kind of afternoon slump, it can work like your little after lunch
little pick me up. Yes. Okay, wonderful. Yeah. I love that. Okay. How does a sad lamp compare to a wake up light?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And we do get quite a few of those to kind of understand what's the difference. Should you have both? Which one does what? So in general, in light therapy, the basic principle is to replace the light that's otherwise missing from your life, right? So the sort of espresso shot, as we just said, bright light therapy replaces that really strong light cue from the, say, mid-morning on a summer's day.
Yeah.
So that is your kind of principal light therapy lamp for winter blues and seasonal affective disorder. And the wake-up lights are more of those that kind of mimic that first and last light. So they help you wake up gently when the days are really dark, thing in the morning, right? And so I think it's really important to kind of really quickly explain how that works. And so, as we said before, light is the number one kind of regulator of our circadian rhythm. And so when you kind of wake up on a dark winter's morning with a jarring sound of your phone alarm, you may wake up kind of really kind of sort of startled with your heart rate
abrupt or
racing, with your breath kind of trying to catch up and things like this. And now that is because when we're asleep, everything is a little bit subdued, and that's our core body temperature, our heart rate, our breathing rate, all those things are slightly slower than in our wakefulness state. Now, the thing that helps us gently come up to that wakefulness state from the sleep state is light. We're able to pick up those levels of light, particularly gradually rising as if a sunrise during that closed eyelid. And that signals our brain, do you know what? Soon we're going to have to wake up. So let's start getting those things that I've mentioned back up to the wakefulness levels. So therefore, when you wake up with a sunrise simulation, you know, you may not feel like you've woken up with light. Maybe it's the sound at the end of your sunrise that brings you out of sleep. But by the time you're out of sleep, whether it's with the light alone or a sort of optional sound at the end of it, you're physiologically ready. You know, you may still want to stay in bed. I can't help you with that. But physiologically, you'll be a lot more ready to get up and go. And that in itself will make you feel in a better mood, feel more energized when you first get out of bed. And actually in 2015, we had run a study to kind of look at the efficacy of these lights for seasonal affective disorder as well.
Yes.
And the preference between that and a sad lamp were kind of 50-50. So quite a lot of people found that this was helpful to them sort of enough. And that's particularly those who are suffering with slightly less severe forms of that kind of seasonally mood disorder.
So maybe both, you know, incorporating both into your life would be great, because you're getting that kind of that calmer wake up and that kind of natural wake up, as if we haven't set an alarm, for example. And then because we struggle with SAD or seasonal disorder, we can then have our Lumi light within touching distance, with arm distance, sorry, and then that's gonna help us.
Exactly right. You know that.
Amazing. Okay, why is light therapy effective for tackling seasonal disorder? I know you mentioned at the start, but kind of explain to me, like, what is its real purpose behind it? Because I understand, obviously, the whole purpose of sunlight and how important it is for us. Because I know in Scandinavian countries, they recommend sunbeds in the winter months because it actually helps people with SAD and deficiency of vitamin D. So,
yeah, well, that's a very good point you just brought up. So vitamin D is sort of produced in our body naturally also through exposure to sun, but that involves the ultraviolet radiation. So it's important to note that SAD lamps are free of UVs to kind of stay safe and be safe for your skin, eyes, etc. So vitamin D is absolutely necessary. I swear by it. I really think everyone should take it during autumn and winter months. As we know, Public Health England yes. recommend that everyone does consider doing so. So if you want your kind of full artificial sunlight, do vitamin D and light therapy for best results, that's for sure.
Okay.
And if we just go back to light therapy alone, and particularly bright light therapy and how it works, as we mentioned, it replaces that strong light signal. And it's because we run the rhythm, right? The circadian rhythm. And physiologically, we are meant to be awake during the daylight hours mm-hmm. and asleep during those kind of dark hours, yes. which naturally is not compatible with the kind of short daylight hours in autumn and winter for us and how we schedule our yes. lives and work and school, etc. So, and previously we also talked about melatonin, our sleep hormone. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't kind of get suppressed enough and is kind of middling, if you will, during the day, it also makes it harder for us to sleep well, because we kind of need to be really alert and build up that sleep pressure in order to sleep well.
We have to relax and yes,
at night.
Switch off. Okay.
Basically, the main purpose with the bright light therapy is to give us that signal, give us that peak that we need that otherwise might be just a bit.
Yeah.
And therefore, also if you're sleepier at night for that better night's sleep. And now
okay.
another bit I just want to briefly mention mm-hmm. here is that as much as we need that kind of slightly more blue light during the day, that bright, colder light, like in SAD lamps, for instance, at bedtime or in the hours closer to bedtime, we really need the opposite. So we need to naturally stimulate the production of melatonin in the body.
Okay.
And in order to do that, the best thing we can do is be slightly more dim and warmly lit environments to kind of, you know, almost light your life
yes.
with that kind of curve of your
okay.
Circadian rhythm.
Okay, right. Final question. Can you give us one extra top tip for dealing in the darker months? It probably makes it quite hard, but just one tip.
I think we've already did the vitamin D.
Yes.
That would be my number one.
Okay.
If I can, just one more, I'd say move your body. And if you can, do it outside, because
yes.
as much as, of course, it's brilliant to supplement your, say, light intake with light therapy, if you can get natural light, even on those more overcast days, as we mentioned, it won't be that strong, but you'll be out there long enough
yes.
to get the benefit. So I'd say
perfect.
Always move your body.
Amazing. Yeah. 10 to 20 minutes on a sunny day and 20 to 30 on maybe a cloudy day, because there's still sunlight, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you'll get other benefits as well, right? By just
yes,
kind of,
course, of
stimulating
course.
Your endorphins and everything to get that mood boost naturally.
Perfect. Well, Malgo, thank you so much. Where can we find you? Obviously, you know, where can we find you on social media?
You can find Lumi at lumi.com or at lumi.lights on Instagram. We do share all those tips for better kind of winter well-being. And it's not just about light therapy. It's kind of that 360 wellness approach that we're very passionate about. So do give us a follow. Hopefully we can catch up there.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time, and you have a great rest of your week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Right, guys, now we're going to be moving on to exercise of the week. I have decided that I'm going to be picking the calf raise. Very simple exercise, but lots of people are running lots at the moment and looking to move their bodies. Lots of people getting lots of fatigue in their calf and tiredness. You need to be looking at bent knee and straight knee for calf strengthening exercises. This means a bent knee will work on your soleus, which is the depth of your muscle, and straight knee will be working on the gastroc and the two balls or the two heads of the calf complex. Super important for any sort of shin splints, any sort of calf issues or calf tendinopathy or Achilles tendinopathy, tendinitis. And you can do this in forms of sets and reps of as an isometric, 5 sets of 45 seconds with a bent knee and straight knee. And you can also do 3 sets of 10 to 12. Coming up after this short break, we're going to be joined by Adriana Brownlee, who is a British mountaineer and adventure athlete.
FUBAR Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
I am joined now by Ricardo Mighty. He is the CEO of Mighty Labs.
I just think if you're going to get into crypto, you just can't think short term. If you're trying to, I don't know, like pay your bills next month and you think I'm going to invest in crypto this month and then I'm going to take the gains out and do something with, you just can't think like that, because 99.9% of the time, the market doesn't work the way you want it to work. It works how it's going to work. The longer you have your investment in crypto, most likely the better it will do.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favorite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote, and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online, or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register to vote.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Miss Chloe Brockett in the studio.
It got to the point where I wasn't enjoying it as much as I used to. I used to love it. You know, it was my life. I wasn't in relationships because I was going on TOWIE. I wasn't, you know, invested in anything other than the show because I loved it so much. And then as I got older, I just didn't enjoy it anymore. I noticed that the cast around me had changed, all the OGs had gone, and I'd all of a sudden become an OG at 23 and was a bit like, you know what, I don't think this is for me anymore.
Politics Uncensored.
They can't turn off your water because water is a human right. It's not like internet, which we can talk about.
Are you saying we
things.
Should all stop paying?
I'm not saying we should all stop paying. I think no one should have to pay.
Their argument would be prices are going up. We need all this money because we have to invest in our ageing Victoria infrastructure, which hasn't, there's been no new infrastructure built in sewage, whatever, since the Victorian era. How would you respond to that?
They're talking out of their backside. It's bullshit of the highest order.
Keeping fitness fun. What the Health with Gabby Allen.
This is What the Health on FUBAR Radio with me, Georges Bertineau, in for Gabby Allen. This week, I am joined by Adriana Brownlee, who is a British mountaineer and adventure athlete. Hello, welcome. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Our absolute pleasure. Right, we're going to start with some quick fire questions. Right. If you were an animal, what would you be?
I think probably a snow leopard, I think. A bit mysterious.
Okay.
Lives high up in the mountains and kind of top of the food chain. I think that'd be, pretty good choice.
Nice. Three words to describe yourself.
I'd say stubborn, determined, and organised.
Like snow leopard, nice. Upper body or lower body?
Lower body.
Okay. Working out in the morning or the evening?
Morning, always.
Okay, early bird. If you had a go-to cheat meal, what would it be?
Probably crispy chicken burger.
Okay, nice. We like that. Who is your dream workout partner?
Oof, that's a good question. I think maybe Mo Farah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Reason?
So he lived quite nearby to me when I was growing up, so I used to see him running around my house.
So an inspiration.
And so he's kind of a role model when I was younger. And yeah, he's super fit, so it'd be pretty cool to see what his day looked like.
Good choice. Last two questions. What is your workout anthem?
Workout anthem. I mean, at the moment it's Messi.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, it gets me going.
And finally, if you could be any sort of other athlete, what sport would it be?
Probably taekwondo, because that was my other main sport when I was growing up. So,
okay. Really cool. Nice. Thank you for that. Right. So, how did you first get into mountaineering? What kind of truly inspired you?
So, my father was the one that climbed when I was younger. So, when I was about 8 years old, he was on a mountain called Aconcagua, which is in South America. And I remember FaceTiming him when I was at home and he was at base camp. Mm. And for me, he was just like the most incredible human in the world. Yes. And so I decided that I wanted to follow in his footsteps a little bit. And so from that moment, we started to train together and he would take me out on the weekends for a trail run or to the climbing center.
Yeah.
And then probably like a year later, our teacher asked us to write for homework what we want to do when we're older. And so I wrote a letter to myself saying that I want to climb Everest and I want to be the youngest and inspire people. And so I still have that letter today.
That's amazing.
And that was like my spark that ignited everything. And so I kept that letter. And for 12 years, it was an obsession of mine to climb Everest. And so, 12 years later, I did it. And that wasn't quite the end, though. It kept going.
Yeah, I mean, that's truly inspiring. I mean, that's great that your dad was kind of that figurehead for you that kind of inspired you. So whereabouts in South America was
that's in Argentina.
Argentina, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's really cool. Where have you been in the world? Like, what would you say your proudest kind of achievement is with?
My proudest achievement was Everest, just because that was my dream since I was 8 years old.
Yes.
And that's obviously in Nepal. And I mean, it wasn't the hardest or the most challenging, but it was definitely the one that made me feel the best at the summit, because it was like an incredible feeling and something I'll hold with me forever. But in terms of like traveling and climbing, I've been to pretty much, I'd say like maybe 4 or 5 continents doing climbing, South America, cool. North America, Africa, Nepal, obviously, and Asia.
Well, some people get to travel the world as, you know, just as tourists and stuff. You get to travel it as, you know, as your job kind of and as your hobby and your passion. What made you want to set the challenge of climbing the world's 14 mountain peaks?
So originally, my goal was just to climb 1/8000er, which was Everest. And as soon as I summited that, I just knew that that wasn't enough for me. And I had to keep carrying on and doing something else in the next challenge, because that's what my life had felt like up till then. It was like goal after goal. And so one of my mentors told me, he's like, look, Adri, you should do the 14 peaks because you're made to do this. And so when he told me this, I called my university and I called my parents and I told them both, I'm not coming back and I'm just going to pursue this as basically a career. And so my parents were like, if you can make it happen and you can make it work, then absolutely go for it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's going to take a lot of dedication and the hardest thing of all is going to be the sponsorship.
Mm.
But then, that was kind of when I set it in stone. And from that moment onwards, I'm pretty stubborn in my way. So it's like, it's going to be this or nothing.
But it definitely helps having parents that are supporting you with your goals and your dreams. I mean, you know, I'm not going to teach people how to parent, but for me, that's the right attitude. Just being like, if you want to do it, do it. We're here, we'll support you, whatever you want, but it's your decision. And I think that's quite nice. And it was, it could have been very different. It could have said no, and we don't want you to do it. So, I mean, that's made you who the person you are.
I don't think many parents would allow their kids to live in the death zone at 8,000 meters. So, I'm pretty lucky.
I guess it helps that dad had done it and stuff. Yeah. So, how do you train for a challenge like this? You know, how do you go about this?
So, most of my training is cardio. So, high altitude mountaineering, what it does is it uses a lot of your lungs and your cardiovascular system, and your muscles are kind of put to one side.
Yeah.
And so you want to focus on getting your VO2 max as high as possible. And so I was doing a lot of swimming, cycling, running, these kind of things in the gym, Stairmaster, that was kind of the favorite. Well, not really, but it was the best favorite one.
I don't think it's anyone's favorite.
No, exactly. And then, yeah, I kind of disregarded like my upper body, and then I did a little bit of lower body strength for my legs, but that was about it. It was mostly cardio.
So mostly cardiovascular training, not much strength training. Do you have an S&C coach? Do you have a coach? Do you have a performance team behind you? Is it just all kind of driven by your understanding and kind of what your dad did and the old and different maybe methods that you've researched?
So yeah, it was at the beginning, I was a little bit confused as to how to train. So my training method has always been like, wake up and see how I feel in the morning, and then I'll just make a plan as I go in the gym.
If you're leggy, swim. If you're, you know, top heavy, Stairmaster, run,
exactly,
whatever.
Exactly. And I always tried to mix it up as much as possible. But then I realized quickly that that wasn't really working. I wasn't progressing as I wanted to. And so I had a couple of coaches that I went through, but then at the end of the day, I thought, you know what I'm doing feels best. And also I had my father to support me as well, he's pretty much an athlete. He's like a professional runner. So I had that support system around me. Yeah. But it's difficult in mountaineering because it's not a team sport. It's not a sport that's on the TV or media. So you never have those people around you, like a psychologist or, you know, proper SSC coach. So, yeah, it's hard to navigate.
Because it's super intriguing because it sounds like something where you could have all the bells and whistles, or you could just do it as a solo individual.
And I mean, those things are costly as well, you know, to have a coach and a trainer or a PT. It was just adding extra. So
yeah,
it was like, you know what, there's online as well, there's AI, there's you know, there's different ways to go about it.
Very true. You've obviously said your favorite peak to climb was Mount Everest. Why is it? Because it was the first one? Is it because
for sure it was just, that was the most magical mountain out of all of them. And
from
the whole
the top,
journey.
The view, the journey.
The whole journey. So even the people that I was with, the clients, the leader, it was just, it was so much fun. And I took in and soaked in every single minute of that expedition. It was 2 months long in total. And with the other 8,000ers, it was very quick fire. So after Everest, I did 5 8,000 meter peaks in like 28 days. So it was back to back to back.
A lot of volume there.
So you didn't really appreciate what it was climbing, whereas on Everest, it was just like a full-on expedition. And yeah, I enjoyed every moment.
Okay, great. I mean, I love that. I find that because you took a longer time over it, it was your first one, you really got to enjoy and embrace the whole kind of scenery as well, because it is, I bet it's an incredible view.
Oh, it is. It's special. It's the sunset, sunrise, the stars. I mean, you don't get that really in London much.
Nope.
But yeah,
well,
it's like beautiful.
What would you say the main challenges were you encountered when climbing?
So there are like different types of challenges when it came to the project and climbing. So there's kind of the physical side of things on the mountain itself.
Yes.
You know, there's, mountaineering is very deadly. It's one of the most riskiest sports in the world. One of the mountains I did, Annapurna, has a 35% death rate. So we're sat at base camp with 20 people and 7 people are probably not going to come back. So those were kind of the physical side of things. And yeah, that was very difficult to get through, but it's all about mental strength. And then there's also the government side of things with permits. So like getting into Tibet, for example, which 2 of the 8,000ers are in, we had to wait a year and a half to actually get our final approval to go to those mountains. So that was another aspect. And then there was the financial, which was the hardest of all of them.
Yeah.
So trying to raise over 750K for all 14 peaks, that was harder than the climbing itself. And that was all through sponsorship. So yeah, I mean, that was like a full-time job.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, fair play to you for raising the money and being able to, you know, achieve that. It sounds like it's, like you said, it's not just physical. It sounds like it's mental. You know, how tough did you find it mentally?
It was tough. It was very tough. But I think my father instilled a very good mindset in me since I was very young. And I was doing mountaineering challenges since I was 9 years old. And some of those challenges, I did the 3 peaks, for example, I got hypothermia on the last mountain. And my dad asked me a very simple question. He said, look, Adri, either you can keep going up or you can turn around and forfeit this challenge. And so I decided to forfeit, which as a 9-year-old, not many would do. And I knew that I was sick, but I knew that I could probably carry on, but yeah. It wasn't safe. And so from that moment, I had a mountaineering mindset, and I carried that through on all of my 8,000 meter peaks. And that's what got me here safely today with, you know, all my fingers and toes and no big incidents.
That's crazy, because I suppose when you think about it, as an individual, you know, I don't know too much about it, and this is super fascinating. You forget about the elements, you know, forget about that there is, you know, a risk at the end of it. There's a risk with anything in life, you know, like we forget that even breathing is a risk these days because there's so many issues in the world. But what you've actually achieved physically and mentally is incredible, really. Like, it's not for the faint-hearted either, is it?
No, not quite. No. It takes a special, unique person.
It does. Do you have any strategies in place for dealing with tough times? You know, I'm assuming there's lots of camping, there's lots of overnight stays. You know, what strategies do you really have?
So, I mean, I have an incredible climbing partner, and nice. So he's kind of like my rock and support during my climbs.
Pun intended.
So he's a Sherpa, he's Nepalese, and cool. And he's been through 12 8,000 meter peaks with me. And so any moment that I was feeling down, or, you know, like I couldn't do it, I couldn't put one more foot in front of the other, he would be the one to motivate me and support me. Mm. And I think that really helped me get through some of those 8,000ers. And two of them I did without supplementary oxygen. And without him there, I wouldn't have been able to do it, because that's taking it to another level.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was mostly him that got me through.
That sounds incredible, to be fair. And the fact that you've got someone there by your side, so you don't do it on your own. You do, because you've got that mental and that physical battle, but you also always have a partner.
Yeah, exactly.
For safety, assuming, as well. Okay. Any new challenges on your mind? Anything you're wanting to achieve at the moment?
So at the moment, we actually started a company together 2 years ago. So we've kind of gone into the business side of things.
Cool.
Which is nice, because I've started making money rather than spending it all.
Why not? No, exactly.
So we lead like treks and expeditions in Nepal, Bhutan, Kilimanjaro, cool. all over the place, which has been really amazing and taken up most of my time. So my training's been kind of on a standstill, but I think 2026 will be the year that I do another personal project. Cool. And hopefully I want to summit Everest without supplemental oxygen. Which would be pretty cool and scary, but yeah, that'll be the next level up, I think.
Okay, so explain your business. So you said you help people, you take people to these amazing landmarks, and you show them safe treks and things like that. Is that how it
exactly.
works?
Exactly. Yeah. So it's trekking expedition company, and we saw that in the industry that we work in. Especially the 8,000 meter peak industry, it's become less about safety and more about the more people you have, the better, because you get more profit.
Yes. Okay.
So this mindset has kind of creeped in. And so what we want to do is reverse that a little bit and make sure that safety is at the forefront, and that people climbing a mountain like Everest, they have to have a CV. They have to have experience in the mountains.
Okay.
Because there's more and more people who are coming to these mountains without a scooby about what mountaineering is, how to put on a harness.
Achieve a goal.
Exactly. Exactly. It's just they have a bit of money. They need, you know, that goal in life, which is fine, but train for it. You know the skills and the techniques before you come and put your life at risk and your Sherpa. So that's kind of what we've tried to do with our company.
Okay, that's cool. I mean, I love that, because for me, I also feel that that's super important. So many people are just like money, 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 when actually people's safety is more important.
Right.
People will rave about you more when you have a rapport where people are like, I did this with another company, but this one was the safest. They made sure we knew everything. They made sure we recited it, we repeated it, instead of it just being like, chick, 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 you know, done, move on. Let's just do the trail.
Exactly.
So that's nice to hear. What is one piece of advice you can offer to people from your experiences?
I would say that, like, one of the most important things in life, I think, is to have goals and to have personal achievements that you're striving for. But more than that, those goals have to come from within, from yourself. And a lot of people have goals in life. I don't know, for example, I want to be a lawyer, or I want to be a doctor, or I don't know, I want to buy a car. But a lot of these are influenced by outside, by media, by parents, by whatever it may be, by friends, and they don't come from within. And that's why 90% of the time you don't achieve them. And so I think it's very important to have these goals, but make sure that it's something that you really want from your heart, and that will give you so much happiness and success in your life. And that's what like Everest was for me, and I'll carry that achievement with me forever. And I think, yeah, more people should try and explore that. It doesn't have to be Everest, but you know, whatever your personal, actual personal goal is in life.
Okay. And what would you say the, so obviously going up is a very slow process. How, what's it like coming down?
Coming down is
people
worse.
Might assume, oh, okay. Yeah. People might assume that it's a lot easier and it's a lot quicker, but it's probably as hard, if not harder, because, like, you know, gravity and all that.
Yeah, I wish. I mean, sometimes we'll, like, just sit on our butts and glide down, but realistically, when you reach the summit, all your energy is gone and you have this rush of adrenaline and you know you've done it. And now the hard part is to get back down. And that's where a lot of people die or have big accidents because the lack of energy, and they're in such a rush to get back down that they don't take into consideration safety. And so people make mistakes on the way down, which is sad, but that's, it's just natural. You know, you've reached this like amazing high and suddenly you have to do 50% the rest.
I get that. It's, you know, it's like, you know, it's not like a set of stairs, but I suppose when you get to the top, you're like, oh, I've done it. But you're like, oh,
gotta
shit,
get back.
I've got to get down now. Okay. Right. Thank you so much for your time. Where can we find you on social media?
So mostly on Instagram, adri.brownlee. And I do a little bit of like LinkedIn and Facebook, but that's the main one, Instagram.
And your business has an Instagram page?
Yeah, business has an Instagram page, AJ Adventures. And then also online as well, we have a website, ajadventuresltd.com.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you,
Adriana. And I will speak to you soon.
Cheers.
Right, guys, coming up after this, I'm going to be joined by Sophie Bertrand, nutritionist.
Foodbar Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
I am joined now by Ricardo Mighty. He is the CEO of Mighty Labs.
I just think if you're going to get into crypto, you just can't think short term. If you're trying to, I don't know, like pay your bills next month and you think I'm going to invest in crypto this month and then I'm going to take the gains out and do something with, you just can't think like that, because 99.9% of the time, the market doesn't work the way you want it to work. It works how it's going to work. The longer you have your investment in crypto, most likely the better it will do.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favorite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google app stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
Is the sound of your mates alive? Is getting to more gigs this year and the next? Is the sound of saying, I got you, mate? Is the sound of mates enjoying even more of this? Is the sound of mates getting home instead of here? Click your seatbelt, because you're twice as likely to be killed or seriously injured if you don't think.
When you notice something wrong, it tends to grow and eventually take over, to the point you can't really think of anything else. If something in your body doesn't feel right, the thought it could be cancer can play on your mind. Tests could put your mind at rest. Finding out sooner is always better. Your NHS wants to see you. Contact your GP practice.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
Have we got Miss Chloe Brockett in the studio?
But it got to the point where I wasn't enjoying it as much as I used to. I used to love it. You know, it was my life. I wasn't in relationships because I was going on TOWIE. I wasn't, you know, invested in anything other than the show because I loved it so much. And then as I got older, I just didn't enjoy it anymore. I noticed that the cast around me had changed. All the OGs had gone and I'd all of a sudden become an OG at 23 and was a bit like, you know what, I don't think this is for me anymore.
Politics Uncensored.
They can't turn off your water because water is a human right. It's not like internet, which we can talk about.
Are you saying we should all stop paying?
I'm not saying we should all stop paying. I think no one should have to pay.
Their argument would be, prices are going up. We need all this money because we have to invest in our ageing Victoria infrastructure, which hasn't, there's been no new infrastructure built in sewage, whatever, since the Victorian era. How would you respond to that?
They're talking out of their backside. It's bullshit of the highest order.
Follow us at What The Health Show for more from Gabby. This is What the Health.
This is What the Health on FUBAR Radio with me, Georges Bertineau, in for Gabby Allen. Joining me now is Sophie Bertrand, nutritionist. Sophie, welcome. An absolute pleasure to have you join us today.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
How are you? Well?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you very much. Right, let's go jump straight into the questions. I wanted to ask you this one. What made you want to become a nutritionist, and kind of how did your career path start?
Okay, how much time do we have? I'll try and sum it up as quickly as I can. So I had a really unhealthy relationship with food growing up. I had very little interest in it, and my diet itself was pretty unhealthy. And growing up, I went through some things, had a really disordered relationship with food. And as I began to recover, I started to enjoy food again. And I was like, it was the first time I was like, oh my God, food can be one, enjoyable, and mm-hmm. two, fuel our body to make us feel good physically and mentally. I had got to my early 20s and never felt really well or experienced how well I could feel when eating well. So I kind of went down this rabbit hole of, you know, doing all this research on nutrition, how food can fuel our body. I also went back to study psychology, and it was a pretty hefty degree. So I started like putting myself on these like brain health diets in like preparation for my exams and stuff, trying to test if like the foods I could eat could like improve my cognition. And I just became a little bit obsessed with it. So I went down the psychology route and then decided to jump over to nutrition, because I also kind of realized that you can tell people how to eat well, but actually the behaviors that come along with that are really, really important too. So I really wanted to marry together psychology and nutrition to help people discover how good they could feel. By improving their diet.
Okay, fascinating. Thank you very much for that one. Why do you think protein consumption is so low amongst adults?
I think a number of reasons. One is there's just not enough education around food and nutrition and what our kind of core protein sources are. I think mm-hmm. a lot of people, when you think of protein, they think, you know, chicken, eggs, dairy, maybe. And these tend to be things that people often cut out of their diets. Mm-hmm. And you can totally make up your protein intake on a plant-based diet. But again, it's, you have to be clued up and knowledgeable as to how you can go about doing this. You have to be, and a lot of people turn towards those kind of meat alternatives when they don't eat meat. And actually, they're not great for our health. A lot of them are quite processed.
Yeah.
So actively including those, you know, things like tofu, tempeh, beans, quinoa, chickpeas, lentils, a lot of us aren't actively including enough of this. I mean, hardly any of us are meeting our five a day, let alone making, you know, sure that we're eating plant proteins as well.
Yes. Okay. Why is consuming enough protein so important?
So protein is one of the body's main building blocks, mm-hmm. and it plays a key role in the structure and function of things like our muscles, skin, enzymes, hormones. It really is key for so many different things going on in our body, and lack of it or protein deficiency can, you might start to notice your hair, skin and nails not being in such good condition, loss of muscle mass and increased muscle mass is associated with longevity as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you definitely don't want to be losing your muscle. Increased risk of bone fractures are associated with low protein intake. And just kind of other things that you might recognize in the short term is things like increased hunger. Protein is the most satiating macronutrient. So if you're not including enough of it, you might experience more cravings, and you might be prone to more severe infections as well.
Okay. Quickly going back on to what you said about longevity of life with obviously increased muscle mass, I saw something recently where they looked at the leg strength of two individuals, and the one who had the stronger and bigger legs ended up living longer because of, you know, reduced yes. risk of falling. And there is a correlation, exactly. I'm pretty sure, with leg strength and muscle mass. So, yeah, fascinating one.
Mm-hmm.
Question I really wanted to ask you. I see a lot of research on how many grams of protein you should be eating per kg of body weight. So how do you feel on 2 grams of protein per kilo of body weight? Do you feel that that's too much, or do you feel like there's no such thing as
too much protein unless we're going into the 4, 5, 6 grams, which would be
astronomical. It's very difficult to say. I mean, the guidelines that we have actually recommend that most adults need around 0.75 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight, which is obviously a lot lower than what you just said.
Yeah.
However, I would say, as a professional, that is your absolute minimum. And if you want to maintain and grow muscle mass, you definitely need to be looking at eating more. Maybe start upping it to 1 gram per kilogram of body weight. So for example, if you weigh 55 grams, that would be, sorry, if you weigh 55 kilograms, that would be 55 grams of protein. But again, I would say personally, and through, you know, things that I've been doing recently as well, more is better. However, you know, you don't want to be consuming like hundreds and hundreds of grams a day. Like, you know, too much of anything is not necessarily a good thing.
Yes.
So it comes down to the individual and what your health goals are as well. So if you are in the gym 5 days a week, you know, you're lifting weights in a lot of those sessions, you're probably going to be needing to eat more protein than your average adult.
Of course.
You know, based on the guidelines that we have. But, you know, someone like me who's kind of, I would say I'm your average adult, I also want to grow and maintain my muscle mass. So I'm definitely going to be aiming to eat more than kind of a gram per kilogram of my body weight.
Yeah, nice. I mean, I recommend for my clients anything from minimum 1 to 2 grams, depending on goal.
Yeah.
Obviously, like you said before, it's satiating and it's keeping you fuller for longer. And obviously, if you're an individual looking to lose weight, you know, there's so much backing that a high protein diet is going to help you be fuller for longer. It's going to help you build lean tissue, which is in time then going to help you burn more calories because your body needs more to, you know, maintain the muscle mass.
Yeah, it's also associated with metabolic health as well, which is kind of what you're saying about weight loss as well. We have more and more research coming out about this as well.
And also, like, it's the fact that our bodies, you know, we've got what our body would naturally burn throughout the day. You know, exercise is the smallest portion. You know, you've got the thermogenetics effect of food, which is, you know, largely based around protein, and then we've got our NEAT, and then we've got what our body naturally will burn anyway, which is BMR. So you've obviously mentioned the guidelines with how much protein the average person should kind of eat, you know, 0.75 and above. You know, you've recently reintroduced red meat into your diet, correct?
I have, yeah.
Yes. Okay. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and kind of why?
Yeah. So I was on a plant-based diet for 10 years and I am a firm believer of, you know, what works for one person doesn't work for another.
Agree. But,
and we are, you know, we don't stay on the same path or journey through every point of our life. You know, since then I've had 2 kids in pretty much 3 years. I've been pregnant or breastfeeding for 4.5 years, and my body was no longer thriving on a plant-based diet. And I started to just crave meat, which sounds very strange to say after 10 years, but I genuinely was craving a steak. And I was like, this is so weird. But I was like, I'm actually just going to see where this goes. You know, I've eaten meat when I was a child, so it's not like my body is completely alien to it.
Yeah.
So I had my first bite of my first piece of steak.
What cut did you go for?
Pardon?
What cut did you go for? Sirloin, ribeye?
Fillet, anyway, fillet steak.
Great, good choice.
Fillet steak, yeah.
Only fillet.
And it was absolutely delicious. And my first bite, I was like, this is right. And I haven't looked back. And I actually got a full body health check a couple of weeks after that. And it came back that I was very low in iron. So my body was obviously telling me that, you know, I was not getting everything I needed from the diet that I had been on for the last 10 years. And I have not had low iron, you know, historically. But like I said, I've had 2 pregnancies and my body was just feeling a bit depleted. So I find it, again, I mentioned before, I'm trying to up my own protein intake because I want to grow and maintain my muscle mass, you know, getting older. And I just found on a plant-based diet, it was incredibly difficult.
Tough,
you know, the amount of beans and quinoa and lentils I would have had to have eaten was just uncomfortable.
Totally agree. So for the individuals out there who are still not keen on reintroducing meat, what alternatives can you suggest in order for to get the right amount of protein? Would you suggest protein shakes? Would you suggest kind of...
I am a food first approach kind of nutritionist. I think supplements have their place and protein powders have their place.
Supplements
if you are someone, you know, we won't go into the reasons, but it may be applicable for you and your lifestyle. Mm-hmm. If you can expect, you know, the more diversity we have in our diet, the better as well, because the greater the range of nutrients we're getting. So if you can include things like, you know, good quality cuts of red meat, quality is hugely important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things like other meats, chicken, fish, you've got dairy, eggs, Greek yogurt is a good one. They're all complete sources of protein. So, I mean, you get all those essential amino acids. And then you've got your plant proteins, you know, things like beans, lentils, quinoa, chickpeas, nuts and seeds, all very good sources of protein. They also can contain fiber as well. However, you do want to be making sure that you're mixing up those proteins regularly so that you're getting that complete amino acid profile. And I would really just make sure that every single meal you're eating, protein is the star of the show.
Yes, like I always say 20, 25 grams if you can per meal.
Yes, I always say 20 to 30. Yeah.
Okay. As a nutritionist, what is one piece of advice you wish you knew when you were younger?
Ooh, oh, gosh. So
$1 million question.
I would say to focus on the foods that you can add in to your diet, not focus on the ones that you can take out. Because I think the more we focus on what we can put in, we kind of filter out the less necessary stuff anyway. So, like, no one's got time to eat, you know, an entire box of chocolates every day if you're packing out your diet with healthy, well-balanced foods.
Yeah, nice. Okay, wonderful. Well, Sophie, thank you so much for your time. Where can we find you on social media?
You can find me at SophieBertrand_ on Instagram or SophieBertrand.com. I have a ton of resources on my website.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for your time. You have a great rest of your day.
You too.
Thanks again. Bye-bye. Right, guys, now we're going to be moving on to listener questions. If you want to get involved, you can DM us at WhatTheHealthShow on Instagram. So, first of all, Gemma asks, would I essentially be wasting my time trying to build muscle by working out before getting a night's sleep of 3 to 4 hours? I hear so much about necessary sleep in regards to building muscle. How important is sleep actually in this sense? So sleep is an absolute pivotal part of repair and kind of growth. There's a lot of people that say, and there's a lot of research to say, anything less than 7 hours isn't optimal. Now, as long as you are resting, there is research to even back that a 30-minute hug with a loved one is the equivalent of a 30-minute massage. That's how relaxing and how helpful that is to recovery. So for you, don't stress if you can't get more because you have sleep apnea or there are reasons why you can't actually sleep. Just focus on resting as much as you can, eating enough food to help build muscle and training the muscles efficiently. Okay. One thing that you need to understand is as long as you are making sure that you're in the gym and you're getting enough volume through your muscle groups, you're going to get elements of growth. Just because you don't get 6, 7, 8 hours sleep doesn't mean you're not going to get hypertrophy in the muscle. You are still going to get muscle growth. Ralph asks, what advice do you have for dealing with muscle imbalances? Fantastic question. So as a rehab professional and a health and fitness expert, my advice for you would be if you have imbalances, you can look at two ways of doing things. Focus on unilateral, so single arm movements, and either focus on more reps and more sets on the imbalanced side, so the weaker side. Or you can look at maybe if you're going to do 3 sets normally, I would look at doing 2 on your strong side and 4 on your weak side. This is quite common in rehab when you are repairing and working on building muscle mass and strength up in an injured side. So, for example, you're coming back from a calf injury and you're doing calf raises. Obviously, we spoke about calf raises earlier as exercise of the week, but you would look at 2 sets of 12 to 15 on your good side and your non-affected side, and then you would look at 4 sets of 12 to 15 on your weaker side to make sure that you've done enough. K Kay asks, what are your thoughts on wrist straps? I use them when I'm deadlifting, but I'm wondering whether I should get rid of them and focus on improving my wrist strength. Wrist strength is not that important, Kay. For muscle growth, the most important thing is that you are working maximally to a certain regard. That means 70 or 80% of your maximal effort. So for me, I would personally say, don't stress too much on working your wrists and focus on keeping the wrist straps and maybe doing some supplementary work on the side. And guys, that is it from us today. I just want to thank our guests for their time. A massive thank you to Malgo, Adriana, and Sophie for joining us today on What the Health. Make sure you guys download the app and listen each week to follow us on social media. We are at What the Health, the show on Instagram. And it's just a massive thank you from me. As always, I will be back next week at 11 a.m. for another jam-packed show. I'm Georges. Thank you for listening. Have a great day. Happy Valentine's Day in advance. Love you. Bye.
Foodbar Radio.